The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Thank you to Richard Palmer for filling in on yesterday's program. I was able to spend a couple of days in Ireland with my son, along with some of our most devoted listeners in that nation, listeners to this program. In fact, when I was in their home, I think it was yesterday morning, he turned on the radio, KPCG, hoping to just have some nice music in the background. And instead of that, it was one of my repeat shows. So I was there in the house in Central Ireland listening to myself, and we had a good laugh over that, and then he turned it off. On Sunday, we traveled up to Londonderry, which was far to the north of the island in Northern Ireland. And what a strange sight there to see quite a few of the road signs that said Londonderry that had been vandalized or spray painted over. They painted over London to where it just said Derry. There's quite a few. Of course, there's a lengthy backstory to this. A long history of division between the Irish Republic and, of course, Northern Ireland, which is still loyal to the throne in London. And it'll be interesting to just watch this play out, particularly with the UK pulling out of the EU, Brexit, of course, and Ireland very, very much remaining in that union, and quite a few of the Irish who believe that territory up north belongs to them. They don't want London in the title. And so they cross it out, and there, as our listeners that I stayed with told me, there is more and more incidents of violence or clashes between the Catholics and the Protestants. The northern portion, of course, dominated more by the Protestants, and of course the Republic of Ireland, predominantly Catholic. So as I say, a long history there, and we'll have to pull together some material and produce a program on that in the near future as well. But what I want to focus on today is, this article over the weekend, I think it appeared in the Washington Post, about the government preparing to take on $1 trillion in debt, or to borrow $1 trillion in this fiscal year. That's an 84% jump over last year. I want to go through that in some detail. This is something we've talked about often on this program. Maybe it's not covered quite as much now with Robert Morley on assignment out in the field and not contributing as much as he used to when he was there at headquarters in Edmond, but still something that we do need to discuss because, as I'll play for you later, I mean, Herbert Armstrong said it was an economic crisis that was really going to accelerate all of these end-time prophecies. And we are fast moving to not just an economic crisis for the United States, but for the world. I mean, right now you have all of this tension in the U.S. The stock market has plunged over the last couple of trading days. And then you have these stories, and they seem like they come out every few weeks now. The U.S. government just taking on all kinds of debt. Following this section coming up in the next segment, then we'll talk about, and you'll see how these two subjects relate. But we'll talk about God's way of give. This was something that I stressed in Principles of Living this morning, talking more about the family and marriage, the way of give in marriage. But, of course, God's way of give is, it's a way of life. It applies to everything. And we certainly see more and more just punishing debt that our nations are taking on. And we're certainly not living the way of give. Satan is deceptive, and he might make politicians and leaders think that they're giving by just continually handing out money. But really, are they handing out money because they want to give to people? How easy is it to just give to people when it's other people's money? When it's all of these oppressive and burdensome taxes that are continually raised to foot the bill? Or if that isn't enough, if $4 trillion in revenue is not enough, or $3.6 trillion, whatever it is in the U.S., if that's not enough, well, then just borrow another $500, $600, $700 billion. Or in the case of this fiscal year, $1 trillion of additional debt. It wasn't that long ago when politicians, they were out on the campaign trail talking about how we needed to reduce our costs, how we needed to cut back on spending. I mean, this used to be something that was bandied about on the campaign trail. Even Barack Obama, he never followed through on it, of course. But he was going around in 2008 talking about how unpatriotic George Bush was because of all of the debt that the U.S. had accumulated under his watch. Here's what Barack Obama said in 2008, clip one.
The problem is that the way Bush has done it over the last 8 years is to take out a credit card from the Bank of China in the name of our children, driving up our national debt from $5 trillion for the first 42 presidents. Number 43 added $4 trillion by his lonesome, so that we now have over $9 trillion of debt that we are going to have to pay back. $30,000 for every man, woman, and child. That's irresponsible. It's unpatriotic.
$5 to $10 trillion during the Bush years, and then during the Obama years, from $10 trillion to $20 trillion. That's debt we're going to have to pay back. It's not $30,000 for every man. Now it's something like $64,000. Every man, woman, and child. Is that irresponsible? Is that unpatriotic? $10 trillion to $20 trillion. Now we're up over $20 trillion. And we're talking about taking on an additional trillion this year. This year, now, of course, Obama and Democrats in general, they're never known for making cutbacks in spending. But at least in 2008, you still talked about reducing cost. Not so much anymore. If you remember, a lot of the comments that President Trump was making back in 2016 when he was campaigning, he was out there, well, bragging about how much he was able to build up on debt. He said he's done really well with debt, just speaking about his own personal business. This is from CNBC. I'll just give you the quote here, and we'll play a couple of clips here in a second. But he said about himself, "I would borrow knowing that if the economy crashed, you could make a deal. And if the economy was good, it was good. So therefore, you can't lose." That's what Donald Trump believes. You can't lose if you're borrowing, because if the economy crashes, then you can make a deal. In other words, you can pay back less than what you actually owe. It's a win-win situation. That's the thinking with so many economists today. He said in 2016, "You make a deal before you go into a poker game and your odds are so much better. It's just a fun game of poker. And look, we have great odds here. You keep borrowing and pumping that fake money into the economy, it's just going to add more jobs and then eventually more revenue. Everyone benefits." A lot of people think that way. Here's what Mr. Trump said back in August of 2016, clip three.
"This is a time to borrow, and to borrow long term, so that we can have the money and rebuild our infrastructure. We can have the..."
I played that quote for you last week from his State of the Union. $1.5 trillion in infrastructure spending. I mean, this is the time to borrow. This is the time to rebuild. And America is being led by a leader right now who feels like he knows how to use debt. He knows how to use debt to make America prosper. He said in that same year, this is just a couple years ago, he called himself the king of debt. He said, I love debt. Here's another sampling, clip four.
I'm the king of debt. I'm great with debt. Nobody knows debt better than me. I've made a fortune by using debt. And if things don't work out, I renegotiate the debt. I mean, that's a smart thing, not a stupid thing.
Well, forgive me for laughing, but that is not a smart thing to do. It's not smart to accumulate debt. And eventually the party is going to be over. The bubble is going to burst, and you're already, as I say, you're seeing some disturbing signs. Now, as I covered with you last week, I think there's a lot to be said for God propping things up long enough for this work to finish, for us to complete his work. I mean, it all revolves around what God is doing on this earth. It really does. And so there is, as Great Again brings out, there's some short-term benefit, for sure, in this new administration, where there have been, you know, a reduction in taxes, removing regulations and such. But it's never wise to accumulate debt and then to think if things don't work out, you can always renegotiate it. One final clip here. This is clip five.
How do you renegotiate the debt?
Because you go back and you say, hey, guess what? The economy just crashed. I'm going to give you back half.
That's dangerous thinking for sure. I mean, what about the creditors? What are they going to say? How are they going to react when you come back and say, hey, the economy just crashed. I'm only going to give you half of it back. You think that's going to fly with China, with Germany, with Russia, with Japan? $4.1 trillion. That's the federal budget this fiscal year. And it's estimated that we're going to take in, I'm speaking for the United States, that we're going to take in $3.65 trillion in revenue. That was the estimates back in 2017, October of 2017, a few months ago. And now there's, I mean, that if you do the math there, that amounts to a $440 billion deficit. And now you have all of these stories about, well, actually, it's more like $900 billion, close to a trillion. And it looks like it could be the same for next year, the next fiscal year. Imagine that, $1 trillion every year. I think it was the first or the most in something like 6 years. So here is President Trump. He's in President Obama territory. You have leaders on both sides of the aisle that love to spend money. They love to spend other people's money. They love to spend money on debt or to borrow their way to prosperity. If you look at the U.S. budget, you've got the three spending categories, mandatory, discretionary, and then just the interest on the national debt. Mandatory amounts to about $2.5 trillion. Then you've got discretionary spending, $1.2 trillion. The mandatory would include Social Security. That's the biggest expense by far. $1 trillion per year that the U.S. has to spend toward Social Security. The program that started just back in FDR days, just in the 1940s, and now it's $1 trillion per year. Medicare's next, $582 billion. Then Medicaid, $400 billion. So another trillion for Medicare and Medicaid. $2 trillion every year. And that's mandatory. This is mandatory spending, and this is going to keep going up. The discretionary spending, military spending, veterans affairs, other defense-related departments and such. Well, that's usually what gets squeezed out when you're drowning in debt. Because then the interest, I mean, that's a have to as well. That's mandatory. $315 billion per year in interest payments. And a lot of leaders and economists who think that, well, even if something bad happens, we can just renegotiate it and say that, well, you'll get back half. this piece from the Washington Post that I mentioned a moment ago. It's another crazy news week. It says here, this is from Saturday, I believe, so it's understandable if you missed a small but important announcement from the Treasury Department. It's a crazy news week because you had all the revelations on Friday about the Nunez memo, and we'll talk more about some of that later. That's a big story in the United States for sure as the Democrats prepare for their response. A presidential administration, the previous one, using the Justice Department, using the FBI, to spy on political opponents. That's the state of the American Union today. Well, as this Washington Post story brings out, you'd be forgiven if you overlook this headline, this announcement from the Treasury Department that the federal government's on track to borrow $1 trillion this fiscal year. President Trump's first full year in charge of the budget, tacking on an extra trillion. It's double what it was in the previous year. The most in 6 years. President Obama, you remember, he was in that territory his first year in office too. That was following the near financial Armageddon from late 2008. And here again, we had to borrow to dig our way out of it. And you can remember some of those sound bites. We've played them before. Vice President Biden, who said, "Yeah, do we have to spend to get out of this this financial pit we're in?" Absolutely. We've got to borrow more money. That's the only way out. And so we pull ourselves up, pull our heads above the surface, and think that we've made it. We made it through that catastrophe. And so it really must work. It really must work, taking on trillions more in debt. We really can spend our way out of oblivion. It says here, Treasury mainly attributed the increase to the fiscal outlook. The Congressional Budget Office was more blunt. In a report this week, the CBO said tax receipts are going to be lower because of the next or the new tax law. So everybody's got their differing view, and it depends on, generally speaking, it depends on your politics. The Democrats, for a second sometimes, they do criticize the out-of-control spending, and then they carry on with all the programs that they want to add, that they want to spend more money on. Well, they were when the Trump administration was slashing taxes or getting its tax proposal through last year, it was the Democrats who were sounding the alarm, saying that that's just going to add to our financial burden, not having that tax revenue. And then from the other side, of course, they think, well, you reduce the taxes on the corporations or on individuals even, and that just gives people more money to be able to spend or to put into the economy. And then the economy grows, and then you have more tax revenue in the end. But either way, there's never, never, never a reduction in spending because there's an addiction to debt. We're hooked on it like we're hooked on drugs. It says here, what's particularly jarring is this is the first time borrowing has jumped this much as a share of GDP in a non-recession time since Ronald Reagan was president. First time in what, a generation or two? This article brings out that the president didn't mention anything about budget deficits during the State of the Union address last week, but look at the direction that the United States is headed in. Quotes from this Harvard economist saying that this is terrible. These deficits and the debt that keep rising. It's a serious problem, he says, not only in the long run, but right now. I mean, this is an existential threat. This is an urgent crisis now. It says here, the belief in Washington and on Wall Street has long been that the U.S. government could just keep issuing debt because people around the world are eager to buy up this safe haven asset. But there may be a limit to how much the market wants, especially if inflation starts rising and investors prefer to ditch bonds for higher returning stocks. some of my Wall Street clients are starting to talk are starting to talk recession in 2019 because of these issues. And that quotes this former tax economist in Congress. It says the Federal Reserve was also buying a lot of U.S. Treasury debt since the crisis, helping beef up demand. So we were buying, basically, we were making our own money, borrowing from China and others, and then just printing dollars. That's how we pulled out of the recession in 2008. That's how we avoided, quote unquote, economic ruin just 10 years ago. We applied all of these Band-Aids, all of all the smoke and mirrors, these tricks that basically would put CEOs over corporations in jail. But if you're a senator or a congressman in Washington, or if you're a member of the Trump economic team, it's quite all right to just take on trillions and trillions of dollars in debt, and then to say, "Hey, if worse comes to worse, I mean, we can always renegotiate and just not pay back our debts. It's a win-win. Keep on spending." That's the thinking. Trump's Treasury forecast borrowing over $1 trillion in 2019 and over $1.1 trillion in 2020. That's the path we're on, a trillion per year. I'm old enough to remember back when, boy, getting up to $150 billion or $200 billion in the deficit each year, that was astronomical. Then you got up to about half a trillion. And then, of course, the 2008 crisis, the eye-popping figure coming out of that. Well, we need to borrow a trillion. And now, yeah, hey, the economy's good. Jobs are coming back. The stock market is up, or at least it was until last Friday. Now everything's going good, but we're still requiring $1 trillion per year. A trillion. You can't even wrap your mind around that. I can't. $1 trillion? $1 trillion every 12 months. And it's just going to keep going up. It says here, finally, at the end of the article, both parties claim they want to be fiscally responsible, but Goldwein says that both pass legislation that adds to the debt. See, they both just keep right on spending. They might talk about being fiscally responsible, but as I noted at the start of the segment, even that's kind of a thing of the past. I don't think you're going to hear another serious politician about getting elected come in and say, look, we've got to tighten our belts, we've got to reduce spending. You come in, you're voted in by making promises, by promising to give handouts. It says, finally, every time you feed your addiction, this is at the end of this Washington Post piece, it's quoting this Goldwein expert, it says, every time you feed your addiction, you grow your addiction. There doesn't seem to be any appetite for budgetary restraint in Washington, but the market may force Congress's hand. See, here we are just growing the addiction. No one wants to cut back. But what happens, as Tim Thompson used to say 20, 25 years ago, what happens when these other nations lose interest in buying our debt? What happens when they no longer have an appetite for funding our deficit spending? Well, Congress, the White House, the leadership of the United States, they're going to be forced to look in the mirror and to face this addiction. That's what it is. The addiction is growing. The New York Times had a piece right about the same time as this Washington Post one. I think it actually came out a few days earlier. As the deficit soars toward $1 trillion, Congress shrugs and keeps on spending. Just keep right on spending. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin urged Congress on Tuesday to raise the federal government's statutory borrowing limit. Further on, it says, yet the need to deal with the federal debt seems to have taken a backseat to other priorities. including the $1.5 trillion tax cut, increased defense and domestic spending, and an expected infrastructure request from President Trump. We now know that's going to amount to $1.5 trillion. Mnuchin's request to raise debt limits stems from the simple fact that federal spending is far outpacing revenue. We're getting more revenue than ever before, but federal spending is far outpacing it. The Treasury must borrow money from private investors but needs congressional approval to go above the $20.5 trillion debt limit that caps the United States debt load. I saw a clip this morning. We didn't pull it, but it was Obama back in his time when he was talking about, look, we'll raise the debt ceiling. We always do. It's always what we've done. Nothing to worry about here. That's just what we do in Washington. We're good at spending on credit. And then it talks about all the promises now the new administration has made and the tremendous cost. Mr. Trump and Republicans are pushing for a big increase in military spending, warning that the nation's security is at stake. The president wants $25 billion for border security, including his promised wall on the border with Mexico. Mr. Mnuchin also said on Tuesday that infrastructure would be an administration priority this year. Mr. Trump has suggested that rebuilding roads and bridges is something that could garner bipartisan support. The White House has signaled that it will seek $200 billion from Congress to jumpstart an infrastructure investment program. This is an investment. What we're seeing here is how much it costs to make America great again, how much debt it's going to take to rebuild America, to rebuild the military, to build a border wall. It says here about Democrats, after loudly bemoaning that the tax overhaul would swell the national debt, Democrats are pressing to secure a sizable boost in spending on domestic programs. See, for a moment, when it's politically expedient, they'll get in front of a microphone. They'll rush to a microphone and say, hey, you lower taxes like that, and it's going to increase deficit spending. Oh, and by the way, we want this program added and this one and this one and this one and this one, and on it goes. It says later on, the deep, dark secret is Republicans like to spend money just as much as Democrats. Which party is concerned about the future? Which party is concerned about the debt burden we're leaving our children? Which party is in any way concerned about the danger? The danger that's there with this kind of reckless, out-of-control spending. My father, just over the weekend, he quoted from Lord Randolph Churchill from back in the late 1800s. That's Winston's father, who said, the first and most vital interest of the nation is finance. Finance! Upon finance, everything connected with government hinges. It all hinges on finance. Churchill said, good finance ensures good government and national prosperity. Bad finance is the cause of inefficient government and national depression. Some wise counsel there. You have to go back quite a few generations, though, to get this kind of sound advice, to get this kind of wise counsel. I talked about George Washington, I think, on Friday's program last week. The farewell address, 1796, and how that he said that, look, we're going to have to be unified. We're going to have to come together to survive. And you look at our government today, and about the only place that they're unified is on deficit spending. Let's spend more. There's a little bit of a disagreement on what to spend it on. But, I mean, in principle, they are in total agreement that we need to spend more money. We need to start more government programs. We need to throw more money at problems. George Washington, in his farewell address, this is him, he's retiring. He knows he had the power to make himself king or emperor. And he knew how important his leadership was in the establishment of this new nation back in the late 1700s. And so here he is leaving office. He's handing America to the people, saying, here's what you need to do. Washington said, as a very important source of strength and security, cherish public credit. One method of preserving it is to use it as sparingly as possible, avoiding occasions of expense by cultivating peace, but remembering also that timely disbursements to prepare for danger frequently prevent much greater disbursements to repel it, avoiding likewise the accumulation of debt, not only by shunning occasions of expense, but by vigorous exertion in time of peace to discharge the debts which unavoidable wars may have occasioned, not ungenerously throwing upon posterity the burden which we ourselves ought to bear. Don't put that burden on your posterity. Avoid accumulation of debt. It's very different than what leaders in the United States today are saying. Use the opportunities or the occasions of peace to pay down your debt. When's the last time the United States has done something like that? I mean, you have to go back 100 years or so to Calvin Coolidge to even find a president who's actually reduced spending. It's unheard of today. Well, as I say, Herbert Armstrong warned of a coming financial collapse. He wrote back in the 1980s about Britain losing its empire and the United States following a similar path. All of these national and material promises that God bestowed upon us, we went through some of this last week as well. God fulfilled his promise to Abraham. He gave us the blessings of prosperity and wealth and power. But look at how corrupt we've become. All of those blessings, they made us corrupt and greedy and dishonest and selfish. He said in 1983, he said, already the noose is around our necks and it's almost daily tightening. Economic ills are starting greatly to reduce our standard of living. He was ahead of his time. You might have been able to dismiss what he said then, back in the 80s. Maybe you still do today. Hey, the stock market's great. We're able to just keep on borrowing. Everything's good. Those blessings, though, they're being withdrawn. And as I say, the ripple effect, it's not just bringing down the United States. It's the worldwide financial crisis that's really going to accelerate the development of so many of these end-time prophecies that we talk about on this program. Here's Mr. Armstrong back in, I believe, the 1980s or maybe earlier, where he was talking about the unification of the European states, the prophesied resurrection of the seventh and final Holy Roman Empire. Here's what he had to say, clip six.
But I believe that some event is going to happen suddenly, just like out of a blue sky, that is going to shock the whole world and is going to cause the nations of Europe to realize they must unite. Well, now I think I can see what may be the very event that is going to trigger it, and that is the economic situation in the world.
That's him from the 1980s, near the end of his life, saying, look, it's the economic situation, the economic collapse that really is going to hasten the formation of those 10 unified kings, Revelation 17, Daniel 2. It impacts a lot of prophecies, not least of which are the many prophecies that talk about the United States following the same path, following down the same path that the British Empire went. Loss of national prosperity and prominence and power. Well, we'll have to get into some of those prophecies at a later time. When we come back, we'll focus in on this principle of God's way of life, the way of give. Quite a lot different. What a contrast with what we see in human government today. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The developed nations have made awesome progress. They have produced a highly mechanized world, providing every luxury, modern convenience, and means of pleasure. Yet they are cursed with crime, violence, injustice, sickness and disease, broken homes and families. At the same time, more than one half the world is living in illiteracy, abject poverty, filth and squalor. Violence and destruction are rapidly multiplying. Many ask, why, if God exists, does he allow so much violence and human suffering? To understand the reason behind this astonishing paradox, request a complimentary copy of Mystery of the Ages. We were born into this 20th century world as it is. We take it for granted, but we can't explain it. It's like viewing a movie at a point already near the end. We see what is occurring at that point, but not having seen it from the beginning and not knowing how events developed to the point of viewing, we simply cannot understand what we are seeing. Mystery of the Ages transports you back to the beginning of the movie, to the foundation of this present evil world. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
This morning in Principles of Living class, we talked about, well, we've been talking about, as you heard, I think some last week at the end of one of my shows, about what it says in the Bible regarding a husband and wife being one flesh and how that they're to be, if their minds have been open to the truth, one spirit. You can see that at the end of 1 Corinthians 6, that oneness that God wants for us to have in the marriage and in the family. And in this morning's class, I just talked about how that when a spouse or a husband and wife team these compliments to one another, that when they're both living the way of give, that when they're both loving the other more than self, that's what really solidifies that marriage as that rock-solid foundation on which the family can raise up. The way of love, the way of give. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 6 that your body is not your own. I mean, we belong to Jesus Christ. And he continues talking about marriage in 1 Corinthians 7 saying, you know, your physical body belongs to your spouse. Your body, your mind is not your own. God is our maker. God brought us into existence. God is the one who wants for us to serve him and his work, to use that body and that mind in service to God. Well, as I say, it's a principle of living that goes beyond marriage. It's everything. Look at what I covered in the first segment with respect to managing finances. The Bible says the wicked borrows and cannot pay back, but the righteous is generous and gives. God says if you borrow and you can't pay it back, you are wicked. Those are wicked ways. You look at what the United States has done to itself. Look at the hole that we're in, the pit that we're in. And because of what? Because we're eagerly trying to live the way of unselfish, outflowing concern for others? Is it really generous and benevolent for a politician to come along and say, hey, it's like we were discussing in our editorial meeting this morning. Richard Palmer was telling me about a speech at in the EU Parliament in Brussels. All of these leaders hopping up, one saying, well, because of this disaster, we need to give $100 million to such and such. And then another one rise up, no, it should be $150 million. And then another, $200 million. These politicians feeling good about themselves and how giving they are, how eager they are to spend other people's money. That's what it amounts to. And Richard mentioned one who stood up and said, look, if you're so eager to give, give something of yours to help. That's the way of God. God says it's more blessed to give than to receive. That's in Acts 20 and verse 35. We mention that verse often. Jesus said, if you're out there giving, then you will be blessed. If you're out there giving cheerfully, then you will be blessed. If you're living within your means, saving, managing, preparing for the future, thinking about your children, then you will be blessed. Bringing God into our finances, just like our books bring out, the couple of books we have on the subject. There was this study recently. This is from a couple of weeks ago, January the 18th. How about this? I hope they didn't spend a lot of money to conduct this study, but according to a recent study, did you know that being generous will help you live a happier life? It's like Sam and I always say, you know, spending tens of thousands of dollars to try to figure out something that's stated in the book of Proverbs. A recent study that being generous to others boosts happiness, it says. Just thinking about doing something nice for someone else makes people feel happier. It says the research team recruited 50 healthy adults. Participants were promised money for which they'd receive over the course of a two-week period, and they were required to spend the cash. Half of the participants were tasked with spending the money on someone other than themselves, while the other half committed to spending the money solely on themselves. So which half do you suppose was happier? You guessed it. The ones who had their minds off of themselves and onto others. The researchers found that those who acted more generously reported feeling happier compared to those who acted selfishly. Interestingly, spending more money on other people didn't necessarily make an individual any happier than someone who spent less. Just being in the spirit of giving, bringing that principle of give into our day-by-day lives. It quotes one of the researchers saying, it's remarkable that intent alone generates a neural change before the action is actually implemented. Well, it talks about even the change in your thinking, and that if it leads to action, look at the joy that it can bring into your life. Now, of course, we would take that study and then add to that all the instruction of the Bible and the fact that God's Spirit is the spirit of love. It's the spirit of unselfish giving. It's His way of life. My father discussed this, or at least the principle of God's way. This is in Doers, Not Hearers Only, on the Key of David. I think this was from a few years ago, clip 7.
If you do it, so God has established the way of life that will give us all kinds of wonderful blessings. But if we violate that way of life, we actually bring misery and unhappiness into our lives.
Two ways of life, the two trees, as Mr. Armstrong often said, the tree of life, which symbolized or represented God's Holy Spirit, the Spirit of love, the Spirit of sacrifice, the Spirit of unselfish, outflowing concern, as opposed to the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, which is the Spirit of get. Take. Get for yourselves. He continued in that same show. Here's clip 8.
It's more blessed to give than receive. So you know yourself that that is natural. It is natural to just give, live a give way of life, which is a loving way of life, a giving way of life. It isn't natural to do that. And yes, God says you will be blessed in that giving way. And you'll learn to live it. And it will bring wonderful blessings into your life. You see, if you do this, you will then live a different way of life. You will live a give way instead of a get way. Now that's what this Bible is all about. And oh, the blessings that does bring to you.
Mr. Armstrong, of course, wrote about that way of give in so many of his publications and books and booklets. That law of give that flows away from self. Love toward God, toward neighbor, toward your spouse. Listen to what Mr. Armstrong said. This is from a message on God's master plan back in 1980, clip 9.
God's law is the way of give, because it's going out from self, the giving of love, equal to your own self-concern. Now, the opposite way, then, the transgression of that way, is the way the world is on, the way of get. And I put everything, there are only the two ways of life, two philosophies of life, and you're living one way or the other, every one of you. Either you're living in the way of give or you're living in the way of get.
Now, all of those politicians that are so eager to spend money that's not even there, are they really living the way of give? Are they really showing a concern for their children and their grandchildren? What did George Washington say? Look, we don't want to leave this to our posterity. This is something that we should pay. This is a burden that we should take care of. I mean, we're the parents. We're the adults. We want to look out for our children. We want to leave them an inheritance even. We want to leave them wealth and prosperity. We don't want to borrow and then leave it to them and then give them the tab as if that's the responsible thing to do. I can't imagine. My son's been reading a lot about economics of late. He's just taking a personal interest in it. And so I've been trying to emphasize Bible principles. And it makes me so thankful for what God has given us, for the basic teachings of the Bible, practical instruction. The wicked borrows and cannot pay back, but the righteous is generous and gives. What does it say about our nations when the leaders of those nations, if they were doing the same things with ExxonMobil or with some other big corporation, they'd most likely be prosecuted and put in prison. And yet governments get away with it routinely. And taxes keep going up, and so does deficit spending. Two ways of life, two philosophies of life, and you're either living one way or the other. The way of give is the way of love. Love toward God and God's family, and then love toward neighbor, your fellow man. Two great commandments. Jesus spoke about those. And those two great commands are subdivided into the two great sections of God's law in the Ten Commandments. The first four showing love toward God, and the last six, love toward your neighbor, your fellow man. One final clip here. This is from Mr. Armstrong, clip 10.
Why is it, my friends, that people seem to have the idea that God is a harsh, stern God who doesn't love us and who has no love but wants to make us miserable?
that he wants you to be poor, he wants you to be ignorant, he wants you to be unhappy, he wants you to give up everything that would make life worthwhile. Now, where did that idea originate? I'll tell you, it originated from the devil. That's not true. God says through John that he wishes above all things that we might be prosperous and in good health. Of course, that's physically speaking, but God also wants you to have every happiness. Jesus said, "My joy I give to you and leave with you." He had joy to give. God is the very source of all happiness. God wants us to be happy.
God is the source of every good gift. All good gifts come from above. Even without all of the advantages of monetary wealth, we can give joy. We can give love. We can give our heart to God. We can pour our hearts into His work. We can strive to better ourselves, to increase our wealth so that we can support the work more, so that we can give away more. And then as we do, we will be blessed. Just as Paul said there in Acts 20, paraphrasing Jesus, it's astounding that people don't just look into the Bible, Old Testament or New, and just take God's word at face value and use it and believe it. Instead, they've got to put a lot of money into all kinds of studies and research to try to figure out if people are going to be happier giving or taking. Look at all the unhappiness in the world today. It's because of mankind living the way of get and taking. And we're bringing so much misery and suffering onto ourselves because of it. Why not work in the opposite direction and trust God? Try giving yourself away. One of the gals pulled together a little bit of research from a book that goes by that title. I think it was first written back in 1970. Try giving yourself away. This author talked, or he adopted this giving away hobby of his. And you know what he found? He was surprised. He shouldn't have been, but he was surprised to find just how much happiness that brought into his life. Here's someone that just tried to do it on a carnal level. He tried to just give himself away. And I have some excerpts here from his book. Maybe we can cover that at another time. But how much more for those of us in God's church, our minds opened to God's truth, how much more should we be striving each day to give to our spouse, to give to our children, to give to the community or the neighborhood, to give to the church, to give to God's work? The way of love. Mr. Armstrong, I'll conclude with this. It's from Mystery of the Ages. You're familiar. I know so many of you are familiar with this quote, classic quote. He says, "Can you realize that every unhappiness, every evil that has come to humanity has been the result of transgressing God's law? Every bit of unhappiness and misery in this world today, that's what it comes down to. Sin. Disobedience to God's law of love." And then he says this, "If no one ever had any other God before the true God, if all children were reared to honor, respect, and obey their parents, and all parents reared their children in God's ways, if no one ever allowed the spirit of murder to enter his heart, if there were no wars, no killing of humans by humans, if all marriages were kept happy and there were no transgressions of chastity before or after marriage, if all had so much concern for the good and welfare of others that no one would steal, and we could throw away all locks, keys, and safes, if everyone told the truth, everyone's word were good, everyone were honest, if no one ever coveted what was not rightfully his, but had so much outgoing concern for the good and welfare of others that he really believed it is more blessed to give than to receive. What a happy world we would have. Yes, indeed. What a happy world this would be. What a contented world this would be. What a cooperative, unified world this would be. If everyone lived the way of give, that world is coming. That world is described in vivid detail in Mr. Armstrong's wonderful book, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.